sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
The S&P is down for the first week of 2013. Insiders are selling, and the Fed may be sending a little bit of a signal. Your questions are answered and much more. All this on episode number 302 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. It's the final week of February. Andrew Horowitz here to talk to you about the markets, economy, what's going on with sentiment, and so much more to hopefully get you in the rhythm of what's happening with markets here and around the world. And as always, there's plenty to discuss that we are going to dig into today and kind of give some, hopefully some resolution to the directionality of the current market and the conditions. I have a lot of questions that I want to answer. Actually, we culled through a few of them to get the things that I think would be the most interesting to talk about. And for those of you that did send in your questions, thank you so much. Many of you I did answer back personally, and some of you we're going to answer back on this episode. So I guess we could dig into the fact that, yeah, the S&P was down for the first time in 2013. And if you were listening last week, we talked about how virtually every one of my important contrary indicators, the KRI study, the indicator that looks at the key reversals, was at about a 2, 2.5. And I said that that wasn't really at a point where we should see a major pullback, but there is some other things that were kind of giving me pause. We looked at the Z-score. That was a chart that we put up on the website last week. We looked at things like the Spearman and trend stall, as well as candle patterns. And you know what? They all said the same thing. And when all the indicators are starting to point to the same exact kind of outcome or conclusion, you have to take that and put that into perspective and say, you know, is this something that is imminent? Is this something that is realistic? And what should I do from here? Well, again, we talked about this last week a lot in the episode. If you haven't listened, go back and listen, because we talked about how things were getting very frothy. That was the title of the episode. It was a froth alert, and that there was some conditions that were really presenting themselves as a quote-unquote overbought circumstance, where markets were getting too hot, too overheated, and it was really sending a signal. So going back to that, we looked at that, and we did, in fact, sell out every position in our portfolio last week, or the prior week, and actually kept a lot of shorts on and increased the shorts into Tuesday with a very substantial amount of oil being shorted, crude oil being shorted, which looked like it was significantly overdone. And at the same time, we had some long yen on, which didn't go really anywhere, but did increase the allocation to short on the Qs, short on the small caps, and short on the S&P. As well as had a couple of short positions in individual names. Now, that played out very nicely. In fact, on Thursday in the afternoon, late afternoon on Thursday, when markets started to stabilize a bit, we took off most of those short positions, took off the oil for a very healthy profit, and we actually went into Friday very much, I would say, still short, but a couple of long positions we added to the portfolio that had dropped significantly or that had held up very nicely, even with the downside move in markets. So when you look at that, you have to consider the fact, you know, if a stock is really strong, when you're seeing a lot of downside pressure, that should be something that you look at and say, hey, what's going on there? Why isn't that selling off? And if it isn't, is that a sign of real strength underlying this and that there really aren't any sellers that are attacking this, or that buyers are coming in and doing what they can to keep the price up because they really like the stock? At the same time, you have to look at the opposite. When you're seeing a rally happen and a stock is kind of, you know, being very weak, but maybe pulls up during the day because there is some kind of optimism or a rally that comes on, or a day or a week, you know, you have to look at that as the weakling, and that may be something that really sells off dramatically if the markets do come down. I'll give you an example of something that occurred on Friday morning, in fact. So Friday morning, there was a report out by Abercrombie and Fitch, and they had, I would say, a pretty, you know, lukewarm at best outlook, and really didn't meet what I thought was reasonable, positive sentiment in terms of what investors would see. The stock pre-market was down about 4% and rallied up to about the even point about just before the bell on Friday morning. We took a short position in that because we've seen what happens when Abercrombie does not beat substantially, and there is a lot of interest in selling the stock off. Well, the stock did sell off throughout the morning. It was down about close to about 6 or 7% at that point, and then stabilized as the market stabilized on Friday. So what we did was we took our profit. That's not a bad profit at that point, about a 5.5-6% half-day profit on a stock, took the profit on that stock and booked it. And it did come back a bit and kind of stayed down. And again, it was because of the market strength. Now, that's just an example of what is a way to take a position that is weak. And if the markets move in an opposite direction, in other words, the markets are strong, you may want to look at shorting them. And again, the opposite is true when markets are rallying, if a position is weak or strong. You want to look at that. One of the positions that was very strong was Shutterfly a few days ago. Shutterfly on, I guess it was, let's call it Wednesday, was up nicely, but bucked the trend as the markets came down and it stayed strong. It stayed strong on Thursday as well. As a matter of fact, on Friday when markets turned around, it was up as high as about 4%. So it really didn't get knocked down very much. It's above a key resistance point, which now turns into support. And what we looked at was, hey, this is really interesting. Something's going on here with this company. Something's going on here with this stock. For whatever reason, investors are really thinking that there's more to the story here, whether it's going to be a buyout, whether it's going to be a continuation of the great earnings they recently had. Hey, there's something here that needs to be looked at. And that strength should be a sign that for short-term trading, now we're talking about, we're really just focusing on shorter-term trading theories here. You know, let's call it swing trading. That is a place that you want to look at to either add, subtract, or short in your portfolio. Again, this should be a component of your portfolio, probably that's a little bit of a buy and hold of stocks that you think have great fundamentals and that have good track record in terms of their technical indications. And then there should be some short term as well. You know, you have the diversification. Diversification does not only mean that you're in international and domestic and bonds and small caps and large caps and et cetera, et cetera. It means also in trading styles. So when you look at your portfolio, make sure that when they talk about diversification, that it does really have a breadth of diversification that covers different asset classes and sectors and industries, as well as we'll call it bonds versus stocks and varying overall style of investing, as well as the fact that you have some differential and diversification in the trading style. So the S&P was down for the first week, and why was that? Well, again, we had that condition that looked like there was that if any negative news would come out, there would be a turn for the markets. But also, it was really exacerbated by the fact that the Fed seemed to have some, we'll say, internal conversation between the Fed governors in their latest report that showed that, hey, you know what? Maybe we're not going to keep on providing this incredible stimulus forever. Remember that the markets right now are really driven by liquidity that's driven by incredible amounts of stimulus in the forms of bond buying and low interest rates. That is all Fed-driven. It is a liquidity-driven rally. If we look at earnings, they're not so great. Yeah, they beat expectations, but you know what? On lowered expectations. Sales have been slowing down as well. And around the world, we have a major problem in Europe. Spanish unemployment is still at a record high, 26%, the highest on record. And we are seeing also questions arising about what's going on in Japan, even though they have put the gas pedal to the floor in terms of trying to do what they can to bring the yen value down. And at the same time, China is still a wild card. 1 month of a recovery does not make for a recovery. And if they have a tremendous amount of trading that goes on with Europe, interesting. With the euro continuing to, be very volatile and down significantly last week, you have to wonder if there is going to be a slowdown in China on their manufacturing as well. So the Interesting thing was we had 2 days in a row that were down. I don't think that happened so far in 2013, which is kind of unbelievable in the middle of February. And the question that a lot of people are asking, is this a turning point? Is it simply a little bump in the road? Friday, it appeared it was a bump in the road. But Friday, there was really no volume, no conviction in the rally, even though it kept on moving. And what we're seeing again is the idea that, hey, buy on any dips, how bad can it be? And if it starts moving the other direction, hey, we'll move out. At the same time, the fundamentals, I've been talking about this, in our opinion, have not been what I would say in the recent earnings period, really holding the valuations of this market up. And if, in fact, it is a combination of fundamentals and some liquidity that's going on, you know, if the Fed does not want to continue, and, in fact, if we have this fiscal cliff sequester that's going to, you know, kind of come about next week, which is another topic that is just amazing, that we continue to have so much struggle, so much problem, so much inability to make any kind of headway on any of this with our government, is mind-boggling. But what we have now is a situation where about $85 billion is going to be cut, and pretty dramatically, kind of like just sheared right off, any spending on March 1st if nothing is done about it. Now, what's really funny about this is they're both arguing, both sides of the equation, the Democrats and the Republicans are arguing, hey, this is your fault. Fact of the matter is, this, if you recall back, this was the agreement that was put in place that if, in fact, they could not come up with a budget deal and a deal on this whole thing before March 1st, that automatic spending cuts would be in place, and that was because it was a negotiation on the debt ceiling. Remember that? And I think it was reasonable. In other words, it was said, hey, listen, we're going to work really hard. We're going to work really hard, and in doing so, we're going to come up with a reasonable plan to make sure that we have revenues, that we cut some of the spending. And you know what? If that happens, okay, we're okay with increasing the debt limit right now as a stopgap, and then we'll deal with this, and then we'll obviously solve this, because if we don't solve this, man, look what the automatic cuts are going to do. They're very severe. And the intent was to be a way to dissuade anybody from dragging their feet. Well, we know better. Feet dragging is kind of part of the posture in Congress, in Washington, D.C., and they can't make anything happen unless it's last minute. Now, they were out last week on vacation, time off. They needed a break, I guess. And they're back this week to come up with some kind of a solution. So I guarantee you there's going to be lots of news headlines coming out with senators and representatives coming out with all sorts of commentary about what they think is going to happen. And again, March 1st, which is the end of this week, we will see how markets react to all this. Now, backing this up for 1 second, and after the 2% slide in the S&P last week, of course, on Friday, we had the miracle of a parade of parades of the Fed governors coming out and talking up the economy or talking up their opportunity to continue the stimulus for a very long time, because they need to make sure that, hey, there's confidence in the system. You know that markets operate on confidence. No confidence, people will take it down and just kind of bail. So right now they had to kind of continue on, even though they came out with this report in their minutes. And the guys that are very dovish came out and said, hey, we're going to continue on for some time with this. And markets reacted positively. Now, after the close on Friday, Moody's came out with a downgrade to the UK's debt rating from the top rating AAA, down one notch. And the question is, what does this really mean? Well, the pound sold off dramatically right after that announcement. And the question is going to be, how are markets going to react? Now, a lot of the reports that you're seeing and the news that you're seeing is talking about how it's not going to mean anything. Because, hey, look what happened when the U.S., their debt rating was cut. In fact, it started a market rally. And people were investing in bonds like crazy. At first, you would think that they were going to be selling off bonds, but no, they were buying bonds like crazy. Well, why is that? Well, obviously, it was the best game in town, even with the debt rate cut. And the thought of other cuts around the world for various countries that were in worse shape than we were was obviously resounding. And a lot of people said, you know what? maybe the time is right that I need to kind of stuff some money into the U.S., even though the debt rating was cut, because at this point, there's not going to be any, when that happened, there's not going to be any slowdown by the Fed of buying bonds. And maybe if they're going to be starting to cut around the world, there won't be such a similar reaction to their bonds. And if I'm in those bonds, man, I'm going to get hurt. So let's kind of move it off and move over to the U.S. Okay. Now let's step forward into the U.K. So the pound drops dramatically on this announcement, and the conversation is, hey, it's not going to mean anything. Not going to mean anything. Ratings cuts not going to mean anything. Well, that's bullish talk for, hey, man, we got to really talk up this situation here because we really don't want the debt to get clobbered, especially when we own it. I think the UK is in a different situation, but still, I agree that there is a thirst for yield. I don't think there's going to be the mad rush for the bonds of the UK, but I do think that the potential is for the US bonds to have a little bit of a rally here because there is that same situation that is out there that, hey, the rating services are being much more proactive. And maybe where are we going to put our money? We don't want to get hurt. And especially if currencies are coming down as they are, hey, let's put it in the U.S. Now, we saw the U.S. dollar has been moving up. As a matter of fact, it's at a multi-month high, over 81 as the euro is slipping and the yen is slipping as well. Same time, we're seeing gold stagnate, not really moving very much at all. And oil prices have moved down, yet gasoline prices have been very solid. In fact, even with the big drop in oil prices, the gasoline prices are still extremely high, which is a major negative to the economy. I don't care what anybody says. I really don't. You add in the price of gasoline and where it's gone and the fact that you have a payroll tax hike clearly is a negative to sales from the consumer standpoint and how much they will spend. In fact, we had some restaurants come out last week and some clothing retailers come out last week. We had Walmart come out and say consumers are slowing down their spending, and it is clearly identified as a combination of some confidence, but also it is mainly because of the fact that they don't have as much money to spend due to the fact that there's higher gasoline prices and the payroll tax holiday has gone away. Now, who are you going to believe? You got to believe the retailers and the consumer-related stocks and the companies and management there, what they're saying, or are you going to believe these analysts out there and these people, these talking heads on TV that are constantly just saying the same thing over and over and, in fact, said the same thing back in 2007-ish when rates on gasoline prices were going up through the roof? And they said, the higher price of gasoline isn't going to hurt this economy. Yet they do say lower prices will help the economy. Now, hello, can somebody please clear this up for me? Which one is it? Gasoline prices won't hurt if they go up, but they do benefit if they go down? So the economy benefits on one side and not the other? How is that possible? It's simple math. It's simple math. You just got to kind of, when you listen to these kind of things and somehow it seems that they're just not right, realize that they're probably not. In fact, at the top of the show, we mentioned that insider selling is picking up. Now, listen to this. This is interesting because insider sales have reached about a 2.5-year record as the S&P is going up. Now, this is from Bloomberg. Corporate executives are taking advantage of near-record U.S. stock prices by selling shares in their companies at the fastest pace in 2 years. There are about 12 stock sale announcements over the past 3 months for every purchase by an insider of the S&P 500 stocks and the companies there, which is the highest ratio since January of 2011. And this was compiled by Bloomberg and Pavilion Global Markets. And they said that whenever the ratio exceeds 11 in the past, the benchmark index has declined on average about 5.9% in the next 6 months. That's kind of interesting. Now, the ratio of sales versus purchase by chief executives, directors, and officers of the S&P 500 companies is more than twice the average ratio of 5.4% over the past 10 years, according to this research piece. And in the months after the ratio was last this level, it retreated as much as 19% from April to October of 2011. So this is really kind of an interesting study that was done. And we had sales by Dollar General, BlackRock, Capital One. And it goes on to talk about how executives may be reacting to concerns about slower economic, that the growth rate that's triggered by increase in payroll taxes and spending cuts, debates over the federal budget, blah, blah, blah. And I think the really interesting thing was that I think this part where executives at 153 companies in the S&P 500 unloaded shares between February 11th and February 15th with announcements of sales outnumbering buys by 17 to 1. Larry Page from Google, 40 million. Rupert Murdoch, 34 million. American Express chief sold 29 million. Keeps on going on and on and on. Eric Schmidt is Google chairman, going to be selling another 3.2 million shares. And you know, this is a lot of selling that's going on. Even though we had investors deposit $37 billion into equities in January, which is the most since 2004, after pulling about $300 billion out of stocks since the market bottomed, which is really interesting. And oftentimes, you know, we say smart money, dumb money, this concept that you think about. But oftentimes, whatever the retail investors do in terms of flow is quite at the tops and the bottoms. So I think that, you know, we're looking at that insiders are not really buying this rally. They're really selling it. And that's something that we need to pay attention to. And we combine that with some of the other things that are going on in markets around the world and economics and the indicators that we've been talking about. It should be a simple heads up and kind of an alert, something that you need to think about, something you need to consider. How are you going to position your portfolio? And I told you how we have already. And right now we are really looking at a much more negative picture than we are positive. And, you know, it looks like that big rally from the beginning of the year is in question right now. And we would say that, you know, give me something more. Give me some better economics, and maybe that will change. Now, before we get to some of the questions that were sent in, I want to kind of talk about the economics for next week, because there's some important things that are going to be coming up here that will then tie out to our conversation. Now, last week we saw a variety of things, but the one thing that stuck out very dramatically was the Philadelphia Fed that came in, I think, negative 15, and that's a pretty negative number. Now, in the last several podcast episodes, I have talked very clearly about how the manufacturing is at risk here because we're seeing inventory to sales ratios pick up, and inventory on the business and the wholesale side also picking up, which means that manufacturers may be slowing down because they don't want the inventories rising too much, which would mean they'd have to sell it at a discount. That also means that sales have been slowing down or not keeping pace with inventories. And however you slice that, what that means in the end is manufacturing is going to slow unless we see a major pickup in sales. So now we have the Dallas and the Chicago Fed coming out with some numbers this week. We also have the housing numbers that are going to be coming, the Case-Shiller on Tuesday, as well as the consumer confidence numbers. Now, the idea here is that they think that the Case-Shiller numbers on the 20-city year-over-year numbers is going to come in at about 6.6%, which will confirm the housing recovery is still on track when the prior was at 5.52%. Pretty impressive numbers. New home sales have been kind of a question right now. As you saw, existing home sales starting to slow and some pending numbers slowing, and new home building is slowing down a little bit, and we saw that in the sentiment of builders came down a bit. So we're going to kind of look at this very, very closely. Now, durable goods orders, the survey is looking for about a negative 4.6 when the prior was a plus 4.6. And if you take out non-defense and aircraft, looking for a negative 0.9. Now, if you have a negative 0.9 number, obviously that's a major slowdown in here. So you have to consider that if this is going on, if durable goods are slowing down, again, manufacturing potentially slowing down. Now, later in the week, we're going to have the GDP. This is the second survey or the revision now to the GDP. Remember, last time it came in at a negative 0.1. That was kind of shocking. The estimates are going to a plus 0.5. We'll see if that actually occurs. A couple of things that were out there that did actually benefit GDP when you add in the various components over the last month. But the thing that we're really going to be looking at is not only personal spending and personal income. Personal income is estimated to go down by 2.4%, yet personal spending is supposedly going to stay at 0.2% on a month-over-month basis. Now, that's not impressive, by the way. And I would question how spending is going to keep up if incomes are going down. University of Michigan is at the end of the week. We see the final number expected to be 76.3, which is where it was last. But here's what we want to look at. The manufacturing number by the ISM, which is coming out last month, it was 53.1. They're estimating 52.5. And if, in fact, we do see weakness in the various manufacturing numbers, the question is going to be, how is this going to hold up so well? Right? Simple question. Simple. Durable orders falling off, consumers not spending as much, inventories rising, regional manufacturing coming down. How is the ISM manufacturing number going to stay at these levels? I think this is going to be watched very, very carefully because before last month, it was kind of on a track and a trajectory down. And miraculously, we came up with this number, this 53 number, which I thought was, wow, that's pretty good compared to where I thought it was going to be. But I'll tell you something, this month, there may be a little bit of a crack in the armor when it comes to manufacturing, considering all the things that are going on. And we talked about this just a minute. I just ran through all the different things that are going on. And I would be very surprised, and I think there's going to be a lot of people looking at this number to see where the economy is going moving forward. Okay, so keep your eye on that. Keep a very close eye on that. And then, look at that at the end of the week. But all these other things will be on the disciplinedinvestor.com. You can go there. There's a list with the expectations, the surveys, and charts that will be up on Monday morning, first thing. You could see this and kind of use it as a cheat sheet to see what the actual numbers are and to what the expectations were, and then to judge, how things will go. But these will be definitely market-moving events this week. You have the end of the month coming this week, and you have all these numbers coming out this week. And I think that you're going to see a very significant amount of interest in these. So keep your eye on these very closely. All right, let's get to some of these questions here that we have. A few of them I think were really they're really good because they have some of the aspects I think many people are asking right now that you want to know. Now, this one first came from, this is C. Hepner. It says, hey, Andrew, I woke up and had this simple idea. While the governments print money, the banks can't anymore. Therefore, maybe this equals it out. What I mean is Basel III and the like, harder capital requirements effectively mean that banks can't create as much money as usual. Somebody has to account for that, and currently state-owned money printers might just be doing that. So the question is, who will benefit and when will it blow? Maybe it was just a bad dream. Okay, so here, this is what I think. I agree with the fact that banks are maybe holding back more than they had in the past, and that means that loans for homes and various business cycle events may be a little bit strapped. And on top of that, you can forward the theory that, well, if they're not doing it, who's doing it? The Fed. Well, the Fed doesn't, first of all, lend directly, obviously, to individuals. And on top of that, when we look at the Fed, what are they doing? They're requiring providing additional liquidity to banks. So what they're really doing is filling up a gigantic crater, a hole that was created by the housing meltdown and the financial market meltdown. So a lot of the money that they have been printing is really a replacement for individuals that were maybe more hedge funds or institutions that were buying bonds, et cetera. About 70% of the bonds they're buying of the U.S. Treasuries are being bought by the Fed. That's an interesting number. And that's why there was such concern over when the Fed would stop doing so, because between those and mortgage-backed, et cetera, there's a lot of money that they've been pushing into the various coffers of the government, et cetera. So the question then is, what's going on and is this really supportive? Well, the difference is that if the consumers still are not getting the money to spend due to the fact that they're maybe a little bit reluctant or possibly don't have the money or don't want to extend their credit any longer, well, this is a problem because no matter how much liquidity you pump into the system, you're really dealing with the wealth effect that maybe people start using their various portfolios as ATMs as they did their homes, but yet it's still not the same thing. The bigger question I think that you have to ask yourself is if in the past we had a housing meltdown, a banking crisis, and companies were really in bad shape and there was this bailout by the Fed and by the Treasury, by various governments around the world, and what that did was relieve some of the pressures on the various debt outstanding, and of course revive the stock markets, et cetera. The next question you have to ask yourself, I think, is if this doesn't go well for the Fed and for the central banks, And if, in fact, they have to continue on doing what they're doing, and they're creating their own bubble, if you will, and if rates go up and we have all of a sudden these bond vigilantes that come back and really start pounding on the ratings cuts or, you know, going back and pulling their money from Europe, et cetera, who then is going to bail out the governments other than just printing more money? And where does that get us? You get into this gigantic hole of, you know, of an inflationary disaster and money devaluations, which is kind of what's going on right now. The currency wars and competitive devaluations. So I think the answer to the question is that when will this blow up? Well, the only thing is here that as long as the feds can print money and there is no inflation, that's a very good thing. The negative part of it is the increasing debt load that is really going to choke the governments out of any ability to do anything more than continue to either raise taxes or to devalue their currencies to try to offset some of this. So yeah, the Fed is a part of this, but at the same time, again, I just don't see how this is a long-term solution. We have to get the growth has to be coming from consumers and businesses and business spending domestically and overseas. You can't have governments continually funding all of this forever. It just doesn't work. It just won't work. Just like we know that the easy credit that was given can't keep funding the housing situation, can't keep funding spending, because one day there's going to be a reckoning when you top out. And you may argue and say, well, with governments, there is no top out. I don't know about that. It seems to me that we're reaching an inflection point here with many of the governments around the world that just have too much debt and the inability to tax their patrons on that. And that's what happened in Greece. Let's just look at that. So thanks for that question. Hopefully I answered it. Here's another one from David Winchell. He says, it's obvious that we're in a bull market. What do you think that will create the next bear market? Also, where do you see the market going? Dow 17, Dow 20. Thanks for the show. I really enjoy it. Okay, David. So from a technical standpoint, it looks to me as though in the short term, we'll call it 6 months or so, we've seen a triple top here on markets. We've seen indicators starting to soften. We've seen some economics starting to be questionable. And right now, I think that the threat of the potential of pulling some liquidity for the market is going to spook investors. And also because the basic idea that people got back to a point with a stock or a market or their portfolio or a company getting to a point where they feel that, hey, you know, we've reached a kind of a level of growth that we maybe not going to sustain forever is a point where markets do turn down. Now, whether or not it's going to be a bear market, you know, we have to look at that, whether it's correction. I mean, bear markets are usually a 20% peak to trough move in a market. And you see a bull market when you see kind of the opposite in a way. But at the same time, you have to look at, I think, some of the indications that and questions of whether or not fundamentals are justifying these current prices. Now, those bulls will point to an area that says, hey, P.E. ratios are, 14.5, 15, which is below the long-term average of P.E. ratios. Well, that's great. And we look at it on a reported basis, and we look at it on a forward basis. Now, on a forward basis, it's a little bit tighter than that. And I do wonder if margins have been at a point that we're at a peak margin type environment for companies where they've done their best to really lower down their expenses as much as possible, and they took down their headcount as much as possible. They created automation and got rid of a lot of duplication, high efficiency. You know, this is a time when you have to wonder if it is peaking at this point or if it can continue. You cannot get your margins to a point ever to zero, where margins are, there's no cost to doing things, where the spread is going to be, all profit. So there's an issue there where there's a kind of a point where margins are naturally going to go to, because once you get to a point that you lay off too many people, what happens is the efficiencies may or may not go out. But more importantly, you have more people that are unemployed and less people buying, which will eventually backfire on you. Now, put that in the context of a global economy. You have to remember this is a global economy. So it's no longer just predicated on one country and what their economics are and dealing with how their economy will then benefited or hurt. Because when you look at the global situation, you have to realize there's a massive amount of import-export that goes on. Now, to add to my commentary about where do I think the market is going, and then I'll give you the answer here and finish it off, we see the dollar going up, and that is not good for exports. Where you can go and you can find other providers of whatever that goods are, if there are other providers, cheaper because their currencies have gone down. Let's look at Japan, for example. You know, if the potential for the world to look for maybe some machinery is to look at the U.S. or look at Japan, and all things being equal, why not buy a piece of Japanese machinery right now? Because maybe they're, you know, we've seen about a 15% reduction in the price recently. Now, this is where the big concern comes in from the G20 when they talk about the currency wars or the currency worries that Lagarde talks about, is that if you have this kind of situation brewing, it makes an unfair competitive advantage to the other country whose currency is a lot lower and may have the same exact or a very similar product to be sold. Now, how long is that going to be put up with by the U.S.? I don't know. The question is, they're doing everything they can to push down the dollar already, and that's with the fact that we have unlimited QE going on right now. So put that into the big equation here, and I think that the markets are peaked out for a while within a range. You know, we may be range bound for a little bit. And I do think that if things don't perk up and there isn't any significant changes around the world from here on, I think the market does, in fact, go down and it does take back much of the gains that we saw at the beginning of this year and part of last year. I think that's very justified. You know, obviously, you have to watch this on an ongoing basis. It's not just a snapshot in time and say, oh, we're looking out, you know, 2 years from now, it's going to be this, because things change. And to try to put an actual number on it, I mean, from here on, I think we're fairly valued to overvalued. So that answers your first question is, you know, where's the market going? 17,000, 20,000? I mean, maybe one day it will, especially, you know, if there is a competitive devaluation going on and we get to be a part of it. And if there's inflation. And if, in fact, the global economy does, in fact, heal and start growing. We'll see more about what's going on with the global economy later on Sunday night, tonight, when I'm recording this, from China. We'll see some numbers coming out with the flash manufacturing coming out, which the hopes are that things are getting better and that they're continuing on the trend of, well, trend is not 1 month, but they'll make a 2 month trend of increasing and getting in better shape. So I think that, you know, whether it's a bear market, whether it's a correction, again, you know, using those kind of titles, names and characteristics are very hard to predict. And I'm really not in the prediction business per se of a long term, because things change. Always be aware of that in investing. Things change. And to try your best, it's not always possible, but try your best to go along with what those actual changes are to make sure that your portfolio is, you know, acting properly. Okay, we have another question that came in here that I thought was good from James Golder, and he is a bit longer, so let's kind of see what this discusses. He says some very nice things to open the conversation. Thank you so much for your comments. And he says, I've been an investor for some time, usually on a technical basis, but lately I've been trying to shore up my understanding of the fundamental side. Naturally, I've known about dividends and what they are for many years now, but for the life of me, I can't understand why investors make such a fuss over it. More than likely, I realize I am missing something here, but from what I understand, isn't a dividend nothing more than a transfer of value from the actual stock to the account owner's cash position? I mean, since the stock is devalued by the amount of the dividend while the stock owner's cash position is enriched by the same amount upon payment of the dividend, assuming it isn't reinvested, how is this any different than if the owner of a non-dividend paying growth company simply is selling a small portion of his growth stock to transfer the money from the sale of the cash account? Isn't this manually accomplishing the same thing? I know that I must be missing something, but I can't figure out what. I've heard dividends referred to as money for nothing, but given that they're paying out a dividend and it devalues the face value of the stock by the amount of the dividend, I can hardly see this as an accurate description. Please help me understand the love affair so many investors have with dividends. I can't answer that. I mean, seriously, I agree entirely with that. A couple of things that I can tell you about, though, that may be helpful when considering why there is this, as you say, this fuss and this kind of this excitement over dividends. So first of all, if you think that a company that's issuing a dividend has been a regular dividend payer for a long time, and let's say they come out with an announcement that they're increasing their dividend. Well, investors may look at that in two different ways. Well, you may say, well, they're paying back some of the profits to investors through the dividend. And I think really what that also, the undertone of that is that, hey, we feel very comfortable with our cash position right now and our earnings, and we're willing to then provide an additional dividend increase. And that kind of sends the signal that the stock is in good shape according to the company. Because if the stock wasn't in good shape, they wouldn't increase the dividend. And in fact, they may even cut back the dividend. So the company's cash position is good, cash flow is good, and they feel very comfortable and confident that they can pass through a dividend increase. Okay, that's step one. Step two. Yeah, there is that conversation out there that dividends are nothing, but it's kind of like 800 numbers. It's a free call too, right? Well, not really. Somebody's got to pay for it. But most people think that 800 is just a free call. Just like a dividend, you get a dividend. Buying a dividend is not the best idea in the world at all. In fact, you know, when you look at the dividends and you look at the reality of what goes on, your commentary is exactly right. The other thing, though, we got another point here, is that a lot of times when companies issue dividends and they increase their dividends substantially, what they're going to do next oftentimes is a stock buyback program. Because when you, we talked about this over the past few years, when you actually have a dividend increase and the shareholders get more money from their dividend, if a company goes and does a stock buyback, essentially they're getting the higher dividend on the shares that they repurchase. And by doing so, if they calculate it correctly, it could be a free stock buyback for them because they're going to be getting the income from the dividend at a higher level and on more shares. That's why you see so many times a dividend increase and an accompanying stock buyback happen at the same time. It's not a mystery. Not a mystery at all. And why do they do the stock buyback? They do it because, again, if they could do this at a low on a low-cost basis, they can actually increase their earnings per share miraculously. Because what happens is as they retire the shares through the stock buyback, those shares are no longer counted in the outstanding earnings per share. So if you have X amount of earnings and X amount of shares, well, you divide it and you have earnings per share. Now, if you have X amount of earnings, but you have X amount of shares minus what you take out of the market, well, when you do that calculation, your earnings per share moves higher. Companies like IBM have been doing this for years. They're moving their earnings up over the years dramatically. And it's really been a combination of, yes, growth, but also because they've been retiring amazing amounts of shares. And I've always lobbied, and I talk to John Dvorak about this all the time, and we talked about that on the DH Unplugged podcast that we do every week. And I've always said that there needs to be a metric out there that's an adjusted earnings per share based on the actual buybacks that have been done because they don't adjust them. It's kind of stupid. Companies get away with increasing their earnings by doing stock buybacks, and by doing so, they can actually do it for free by increasing their dividend or by very low cost. So it's kind of a accounting trickery when they do these share buybacks. But the other point about share buybacks, and I'll finish on this, is that when there are share buybacks and a dividend, well, investors know two things. One, first of all, they think, well, hey, company is solid. They can get rid of some of their cash. And two, more importantly, company is solid because they're buying back their own shares. And if they are buying back their own shares, isn't that going to hold the price up of the shares? Because essentially, if they drop the share price, the company will come in and they'll start purchasing it. So therefore, you create a bit of a floor. This is all part of the landscape of investing that you need to know about because these are all part of the games and plans and ways that companies will, I hate to use the word manipulate, but will work with their stock to keep the price up and keep the price doing very well for a period of time. And even in the face of downside risk, they feel that they can kind of keep their stock going. That's why share buybacks are not the best indicative point of, when looking at when companies feel good about their stock, because it doesn't really show that, in my opinion. I think that insider sells and buys are a little bit more of a leading indicator than company buybacks. So keep that in mind. So I hope that answers your question, but I do agree that there is no mystery there, that dividends are not something to be so excited about. I guess the only thing I'll just add to this is that if a company does not have a dividend and they actually put on a dividend, it does open the company up to the potential of being invested by some of hedge funds and mutual funds that require a dividend on the stock that they have, like equity income funds, require there to be a yield. And that now opens the stock up to be purchased by those particular funds, which then opens up the universe of buyers. So that's another component of this. So I hope that answers your question. All right, from there, where do we go? We got a few things to talk about. I think we should be talking a little bit about oil and what's going on there. You know, we saw a report last week that showed once again that oil inventories are rising. But at the same time, we saw gasoline inventories. There was a much greater drawdown than is expected. So this is kind of answering the question of why the heck are oil prices going down and the gasoline prices at the pump aren't budging? And again, this is a very simple process of fundamentals and optimism that are kind of not meeting at the same place. One of the things that we're seeing is that, yes, there is a dramatic increase in oil inventories occurring, and the prices were too high, much too high. Maybe that was due to the optimism to the recent change in Chinese economics. It was simply a lot of people moving into the position after they were kind of out for a while and missed a bit of a rally. In fact, one of the things you want to consider is looking at something like the weekly, every single week they put out what's called the Commitment of Traders, COT report. And you look at that, and I think we've talked about this. And what you find is, if you could find the news items on this, I like to look at these because I always see a bit of a contrary, at least a short-term contrary indicator going on when you see that hedge funds are the most bullish they've been since, or hedge funds really increased their positions, tremendously last week. And usually what you find is that, of course, during that week, prices moved, and you would see that as a very bullish signal. Now, as you see that happening and as you see a lot of the players get on the same side of the trade, what does that mean? It means that it's too heavy on that side of the trade, and oftentimes what you see is a kickback the other way. See a return back to a movement that is directionally opposite. Why? Because now all of a sudden you have everybody on the buy side or everybody on the sell side, depending on how you want to look at it. And what happens is that as they sell, the selling happens at the same time. And there's a lot more selling pressure because you have a lot more people that had positions long. So that's kind of what went on, I think, last week when it came to not only oil, but also gold, what's going on there. I mean, people were just, bringing on a lot of gold futures over the last few years and gold positioning. And the same thing happened recently with corn. I mean, if you haven't noticed what's going on with corn and soybeans keeps on trying to pick up and then just getting their head chopped off. Same thing with corn. You got these players that are moving in very hard because the trend was directionally in a bullish format. And when it dips down, they buy more and they get really bullish. And then what happens when it starts moving in other direction and you see all of a sudden a trend change, everybody hops on very quickly and it really takes down the price. Now, that also is the same discussion we have when it comes to markets. Equity markets are oftentimes futures driven, and when you see that everybody is buying on the dips and building and building and building, what happens when the selling starts, oftentimes it's really very significant. Same thing for buying. When you have all of a sudden everybody on the short side and you see the commentary that a short squeeze may occur or that a short squeeze was the reason for it, whether it was a stock or an index or futures, it's because there's so many people on the wrong side of that trade and it just exacerbates the trend in the opposite direction. So when you do see that the commentary is that hedge funds have gotten really bearish and, they have the least position they've had in 2 years or something of that nature, and oftentimes what does occur is when you see that next move and it does happen in the other direction, it's very, very fast, very difficult to pick up on the early part of the trade, by the way. But it is oftentimes fast and furious. So I think that's what's going on with oil right now. I think the fundamentals are not holding up this, what was a $97 price and probably should be somewhere in the 80s. And what we're going to find is a continuation of this sloppy trade right now until we can get a final direction moving and a reality of the inventory levels. And if we do see the continuation of gas being drawn down, the question you have to ask yourself is that because there's a lot of warehousing going on? Or is it because that you're seeing an actual trend to use a lot more gasoline? And I just don't necessarily think that the second is really occurring this time of year. We did mention that gasoline prices are the highest they've been for this time of year in history. That is not going to be able to be sustained. And consumers will not pay. They're going to cut back somewhere. and they're going to cut back on gas. They're going to cut back on spending. Something's going to happen. And what ends up happening with that is, whether it's them cutting back on gas or whether it's cutting back on spending in other areas, the fact is the economy kind of slows down, and that affects gas. That affects the price of oil. So, you know, there's a certain amount of reality that needs to set in, and you have to realize a certain amount of speculation that always goes on with these markets, especially when it comes to commodity futures like oil, gas, natural gas. And, you know, you're going to have people that are buying it, trying to do a quick trend trade, and then you're going to find the fundamentals that if they're not there, it's going to reverse. You also have the dollar and currencies around the world that are kind of moving around pretty quickly, and that affects the valuation of a variety of things as well. You see, the Venezuelan currency was dropped by 30%. We saw that Saudi Arabia dropped their output by about 7-8%. And when they dropped their output, well, okay, it's not just a simple equation of dropping output and therefore we're going to buy gas or oil because now all of a sudden supplies are less. No, it's because supplies are being bought somewhere else, and the competitive pricing of oil needs to keep up with what's going on in Venezuela. And if Venezuela price dropped, at least internally, because the currency was down, you know, they have a lot more wiggle room in terms of, you know, where they can place pricing to kind of attract the buyers to their oil, even though it's a little bit of a different oil and it doesn't run as well as certain other ones. And then, you know, you can go through that discussion of the quality of the oil, and that's why it's cheaper. So when it comes to commodities, when it comes to futures, when it comes to these things like oil and hedge funds and all that, remember that a lot of times you're going to see these very fast movements. And if you can stay on the trade and find out where those particular moves are, there's things like ETFs that you can use or buy the commodities themselves. You know, you could do that, you know, and kind of work on the insides of those transactions. It works pretty well, or it can work well. It could work against you too. But if you have the right stops on and profit levels, at least you can't get hurt too badly if they're, you know, kind of quick swing trades. Okay, then we have the discussion of the yen, and where is that going? That is an interesting discussion because we do have in Japan the announcement coming very, very soon, supposedly, of who is going to be the next, essentially the central banker, Bank of Japan head. And it looks like there's about four or five different candidates. Two of them are probably not as much of a yen dropper, if you will, or a desire to really drop the yen and be very, very dovish, and the others are. And in fact, two of them, and especially one of them, the lead candidates, is very much in favor of buying foreign bonds. In other words, selling Japanese money or bonds to buy foreign bonds, drop prices there. And that's why we're seeing a lot of a fleeing of investors from the bond market in Japan. Now, that goes back to what we were talking about earlier. Where are people going to put their money? Well, if they find that the currency is going to be dropping in Japan, well, and then the bonds are going to be dropping in Japan. Well, they're going to go to Europe? Maybe not. They're going to go to UK now with their, maybe not. Well, why not kind of push it into the US? Now, US rates are really low, so that may not be the best idea. So maybe some of the emerging markets. But yet they stop capital inflows from outside a lot of times, so there's only a certain amount they can do from there. So where are the Japanese going to go? Well, if they keep on dropping their yen, they would be like to be currency denominated, probably in dollars, maybe in others too, but you know, dollars are a good source. And again, that's why they buy the U.S. bonds. And that starts the process of, continues the process of them moving up the prices of U.S. bonds to levels again, even though maybe the economy doesn't deserve it. Now, again, get back to what we just talked about when everybody's on one side of the trade, be careful. It seems to be getting very frothy in the bond markets. And, you know, if there's going to be a lot of selling going on of Japanese bonds by individuals and institutions, hedge funds, et cetera, internally, because they don't want to be denominated in yen, the question is, well, what's going to happen? You can either hedge out their position or the yen is going to, you know, at least stabilize and bonds are going to continue to lose valuation over there because there's a real fear of them losing the profitability of what they own. And if the yen is down 17%, well, their buying power of those same bonds that they had before, the interest rate doesn't change. But when they do sell that or they take the dividend, they can't buy, or the yield, they can't buy products outside of Japan because it's just too expensive or more expensive than it was. Let's put it that way. So that's why we have a position long the yen right now. One of the things is that we don't think that, you know, above a certain level here, it doesn't seem like there's a lot of opportunity for the government there to really push it that much harder. I mean, there'll be some, you know, but we've seen a bit of a consolidation going on right now. And a lot of, I think, the best intentions of the Japanese in terms of the yen are built in already to the yen. There's actually also a great article this weekend about, you know, buying Japanese ETFs and watching the currency, because you can get stung on the currency when you're investing. So you have to be careful about where you're investing in terms of Japan and the currency ramifications on many of your international ETFs. Keep that in mind. Okay, well, we're going to wrap it up there. Hopefully you gained a lot of information right there, and you will have all the information, the links, the things that you need to know on thedisciplinedinvestor.com under the show notes for this particular episode. And make sure you check out all the other things that we write about throughout the week. We had some really good position writing we talked about last week. Each day we have a video that helps you understand more about commodities done by our friends at TASS Professional, which we do have a joint venture with, where we do a lot of the work for Trigger Point Research, etc. So there's a free video that comes on every single day. Actually, there's a podcast right now. If you look up the Daily TASS Cast, TASCAST, you find that. You could find it on your iTunes store, and you can get the videos right to your various platforms, whether it's your iPhone, your iPad, your computer, and you can see a live discussion. During the mornings, actually, usually pre-markets, about what commodities, where they should be, the pricing of it, and their important inflection points when it comes to movement above or below. So with that, I thank you so much for listening. Thanks for your great questions. Again, for those of you that I did not answer, I will write to you personally and give you the information. And if ever you do have a question, you can just write askandrew at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Thanks a lot, and have a great week. I'll see you soon. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented that should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.